Well, welcome everyone, and thank you for inviting me to take part in this celebration. This is my first time being to the Prairie Provinces. I'm from Ontario, but it's just like home. So I've been asked tonight to talk about inner peace, which is, I think, a wonderful topic and quite easy to talk about because it's really the focus of our lives as Buddhists. I don't think I need to explain the topic so much, but I'd like to give a little bit of explanation just so that we're all in the mode. I'd like to encourage everyone to take this as a meditation practice. That while we're all here, listening to the Dhamma is great, but inner peace is obviously something that comes from practicing. So in the Buddha's time, or even whenever the Dhamma is taught, you'll hear stories about people who become enlightened while listening to the Dhamma. And this is because it's a wonderful opportunity for many reasons to become enlightened or to realize the truth, maybe not fully, but to gain realizations on the path. First of all, because you're surrounded by people who are also intent upon the practice and the development of themselves and of their minds, and also because what you're hearing is a reminder of what we have to do, what has to be done, and of the things that we're trying to develop. So during the time that you're listening to the talk, try to reflect on the teachings and to put them into practice as best you can. So the talk tonight is about inner peace. To explain the term, when we talk about peace, this means that we have two types of peace. We have outer peace and we have inner peace. And we can see, to our great dismay as Buddhist practitioners, that most of the world is focused more on outer peace, if at all. And the best they can do is to bring about temporary states of quiet, of calm, of external peace in the world around us, in the physical world. We can see that when we talk about peace in this world, we're talking about in terms of nation states, or in terms of societies, in terms of cultures, in terms of families or people, our relationships with others. And one thing that we might not think about is as being an important point, but we always think of it in terms of peace on earth, right? Peace for human beings on this planet, which for most people sounds like the ideal, that peace on earth would be the ideal. If you could have peace on earth, you'd have solved the essential problems of the universe. But the funny thing, and something that I hope is clear to us as Buddhists, is that this earth isn't all that there is in the universe. I think that's an important point, because it's going to reflect on how we find inner peace, or how far we have to go to find inner peace, and on what level we try to find inner peace. That our lives, our existence, is much more than just this, what we see around us. This is a temporary part of our existence. And if we just try to find peace temporarily on this earth, then we're going to lose that peace. We're going to lose what we've gained. It's something that can't last. If it were that all that we had to do is find peace in this one life, well, then we could just kill ourselves. We could just end it now and find peace. But the universe is a profound thing and is a great and complex system. And there's much more to it than just that. The point being that if we find peace here and now for the nations that exist here and now, well, we can see this has been done again and again in the past, and it's something that is subject to change and is subject to dissolution, like all things. Even if we are able to bring total and complete peace on earth, to have everyone living in harmony and have there be no conflict, so that everyone is happy and well, eventually we know that, as science tells us, eventually the earth is going to become unlivable, no matter what we do. And we're talking, what, millions and millions of years down the road, but that's how we think as Buddhists. We're not in it for the short term, because our understanding is we've been doing this for a long time, longer than anyone can remember, longer than you could ever count. And so for one life, to find peace in one lifetime or in one mode of existence is not that impressive to us. We have to go a lot deeper. The other thing, of course, that should be clear to us is that outer peace is not real peace at all. When you make peace between nation states, it has to be admitted you set the stage for inner peace. Because, you know, like the story of the Buddha, there was a man who came to listen to his teaching, and the Buddha wasn't going to teach him. The Buddha asked the monks to get him some food because he was hungry, and the monks were quite surprised at this. But the Buddha explained that if you don't satisfy the basic needs of the people who are going to listen to the Dhamma, they obviously can't benefit from it. And so it's not something that we should reject or dismiss. It's something that the external peace and finding peace on earth and trying to make peace with our neighbors and to give up our patriotism and our bigotry and so on, to be able to see that we're all beings on looking for happiness. We're none of us looking for conflict. We all want to be happy and you know, we try our best to be happy and to make peace in this way, so that we can all practice the Buddha's teaching or practice the Dharma. But it's not enough, and it's not true peace. And we shouldn't be fooled into thinking that just because we live in a country where there is no war now, where there is no conflict, that somehow we live in peace. It's very easy for us to become negligent in this way, to become pamada, as the Buddha said. It means, intoxicated in a sense. We become intoxicated with our well-being. We have money, we have luxury, we have comfort, and so on. And so we forget about all of the potential dangers that are out there. Sri Lanka was like this, I suppose. Before the civil war, everyone was telling me in Sri Lanka what a wonderful country it was before the war. And so you can imagine how negligent the people would become as a result. And now the people have really woken up, now that the war is over, and they have a chance to attend to the higher things in life, like meditation practice. They're really keen on it because they can see the suffering and they know the danger of being negligent. They've been through it. So true peace has to come from within. I think if you look, just a superficial look at how wars are caused and how they're perpetuated, it's easy to see that what's going on is actually inside the hearts of people. I think as Buddhists, this is quite clear. But it bears repeating. That inside of all of us are the cause of war. It's our greed. In fact, even in a society that it is at peace, we are a part of the problem. Our need for luxury, our need for things like gold and various precious metals and so on, is a cause for conflict in other parts of the world. Our need for these things, our need for luxury and so on, is a cause for conflict. Our greed, our attachment and so on. But, of course, closer to the root of the problem, the reason why people go to war in the first place is because of their greed, because of their anger, because of their ego, because of patriotism, because of so many things that we would much better do without. And these are the causes of conflict, the causes of war, the things that are inside of our own heart. There are stories of Tibetan monks that can sit in the snow and after, you've all heard these stories, after some period of time all the snow melts around them. The story I heard is they wrap themselves in wet cloths and then go and jump in the snow or sit in the snow. And they have contests to see who can melt the most snow around them. I don't know if it's true, but this is what I heard. So we can all think like that now. We can radiate warmth, the warmth of the Buddha Dhamma, the warmth of metta. Metta is something that is always the right temperature all the time. Not too hot and not too cold. Or for those of you who were at my retreat, you can practice the meditation of saying cold, cold, cold. It really works. I used to walk through the snow this way. Walk just with this, what I'm wearing, we would walk to school and so on, to university. So what I'd like to talk today about is, actually, I'd like to modify the title a little bit. I'd like to talk about the path to inner peace. Because it's really the path that's most important. We shouldn't jump ahead and just want to talk about the good things. More important than the good things that come from the Dharma practice is the Dharma practice itself. Because, as the monk Nagasena said, this is a monk in ancient India, he said, just like when a king has to conquer the country, you know, once he's conquered the country, it's great. He's got all the luxury and all the power in the world. But the path to victory is a very difficult one. It's full of hardship and conflict and danger and so on. And so we should be aware that on the path, he said, in the same way, the path to enlightenment, the path to our inner peace, is going to be fraught with difficulty and danger. It's going to challenge us. It's going to force us to look at the things inside that we don't want to look at. So we shouldn't be complacent and think that somehow we're just going to sit down and feel inner peace. And if we do feel peace sometimes, we shouldn't be complacent thinking that it's going to last forever. We should try to dig as deep as we can and to really, really find the roots of suffering and the root causes of conflict. And that can be a difficult and challenging journey. So much more important for us to concentrate on the journey. And if we're on the right path, we'll see as we go that we're actually gaining more and more inner peace. When we gain the inner peace, we should not rest content, but we should continue on until we find true freedom from suffering and true inner peace, and the final goal of Buddhism. So, what is the path to inner peace? Well, if we're going to talk about the path to inner peace, first of all, we have to put it in context. Now we've understood the difference between inner peace and outer peace, but what about the various paths that we can take? Well, we understand that not all paths lead to inner peace. Not everything we could do or every way we could train ourselves will lead us to inner peace. This is important to understand. I think there are... It's too easy for us to say that all paths lead in the same direction. Not even all good paths will lead us to the final destination. And I'd like to explain what I mean by this. There are many paths which lead us to bad destination, to a bad result. But there's only one sort of path, and it can be different in the way it's performed, but there's only one sort of path that's going to lead us to true inner peace. So this is what I'd like to explain. According to as I've been taught, there are seven paths that we can take. And these don't have anything to do with any school of Buddhism or school of teaching or any religion or so on. It's sort of a scientific theory, you could say. So it's a theory that we can test. You can hear me out. And then you can test it. You can try it out and see for yourself. You can pick one of the paths and follow them and see where it leads you. Or you can believe me and just follow the right one and skip ahead. That's probably the best idea. Try that one first, and if it doesn't work, then try one of the other ones. Try to stay away from the ones that I say lead to bad things. No, you have to be careful as well. This is very much off topic, but important to understand that we don't need to try everything out. You don't need to learn everything. I was given one of these little jelly things in Asia. They have these jellies. And it said on it, chew before you swallow. But it didn't say why you have to chew before you swallow. So I thought, well, let's see what happens. So I opened it up and I swallowed it and I almost choked to death. So I said, okay, now I know why you should chew before you swallow. But I could have choked to death, and then the knowledge wouldn't have been much use to me. So as an example, you don't have to try everything. Sometimes you can take things on faith, at least temporary. The faith isn't going to replace wisdom. But if you believe the person, or you think they're credible, and the Buddha was pretty credible, I think, then you don't have to learn everything that the Buddha taught. You can take some of it on faith and listen to what he said. The same with teachers. You don't have to doubt everything they say, because they've been there. They've gone through the difficulties, and so they can help you avoid them. So the first path, we have seven here that I'm going to go through. The first path that we understand is, or that we recognize, is the practice that leads you to hell. I'm going to go through these seven, and I want you to try to imagine what I'm talking about. Sort of think about this type of existence. For many of us, the idea of hell is some place that exists under the ocean, they say, no, or under the earth. It's this place where you have these guys with pointy sticks and fire, which wouldn't be so bad right now. No, I'm okay, really. I just like making jokes. Keep everyone warm. And full of suffering, torture. The Buddhist stories of hell, if you've ever read some of them, they're a lot of fun to read. A lot of fun to teach to young children who are misbehaving. No, really. For teenagers, it's a good thing, because especially if they have a Buddhist background. I was teaching some novices, and they were gangsters. They had been gangsters, and they came to ordain as novices in Toronto. And I taught them about the hells. I read the descriptions of the hells, and it freaked them out, because they knew they were going there, or they believed they were. No, but real hell is inside of ourselves. We understand that it's possible when you die that if you follow this path, you can go to hell, so to speak. But the important point is that it's a state of mind. It's a state of existence, right? Like even here and now, we think we're sitting by the river, and we think we have this earth around us, and we think that we're a part of the experience. But actually, it's like we're sitting in a cave. This body is like our jail cell, in a sense. Or it's our, you could say it's like a computer screen. And if we want to see, we have to go jump up to the eyes and look out the window. When we use our eyes, it's like looking out a window. Or if we want to hear, we have to jump up to the ears. And so all of our experience is, all of the world is just it's at these six doors. We can't ever escape them. This is why the Buddha said the truth is within, or the way out of suffering is within you. There's a story of an angel who came to see the Buddha, and he said to the Buddha, I was a rishi in India, or wherever, a rishi. A sage, an ascetic living in the forest, and I had the power to leave my body and fly through the air. If you've ever done this, it's a lot of fun. But he was so fast that he could, in one step, if he were to make a step, he could step across the ocean in one step. And so he went up into outer space, just flying as fast as he could, for 100 years. Just his body was on earth. Or I don't know, maybe his body floated and he went, probably not. And for 100 years he went flying through the cosmos. And he died. His body ran out of life, and he died before he found the end of the universe. And when he died, he became an angel, because he had a very strong concentration and his mind was quite pure. And he came to see the Buddha, and he told this story to the Buddha, and he said, "Where's the end of the universe? You know, how can you find it?" And the Buddha said, "I've tried that before. It doesn't work." He said, "The end of the universe can't be found in that way." He said, "But or the end of the world, the end of the loka." He said, but inside of this 6-foot frame, 6 foot tall, 2 feet wide, 1 foot thick, in my case, you can find the beginning and the end of the world. You can find the whole of existence is within you. All truth is within you. All the path is within you. So when we talk about hell, we're thinking of it in terms of reference to inner peace. So hell would be pretty much the opposite. It's some people are very close to being in hell here on earth. If you've ever heard the stories of the genocide in Cambodia, this monk told me he watched one of his friends being pulled apart limb by limb. So it's something you hear people tell you every day. This, the Holocaust in Germany, and so on, you know, great states of suffering. Now, according to the Buddha's teaching, according to the Dharma, there's a cause for this. It doesn't come without a cause. Just like everything doesn't come out without a cause. You wanted to come here tonight, that was the cause. You arrived here. That's the result. Whatever you incline your mind towards, whatever you focus your mind on, that's the direction you'll head. Every moment when we incline our minds towards love and towards compassion, our minds become softer and more pliant all the time. What leads you in the other direction to hell is the practice of anger, the emotion of anger. I don't think this is very hard to believe. If you look at someone who gets angry a lot, you can see how much they're in hell. And the Buddha said that you do your enemies a favor when you get angry. Right? You do what they want, what they're hoping. You give them victory. Because someone who doesn't like you probably wants to see you suffering. And when you get angry, you're really suffering. And if your life is based around anger, if you are an angry person and you act based on anger, you speak with anger as the root, the cause, and if your mind is full of angry thoughts, then according to the Dharma, this is, according to cause and effect, this is what leads you to hell. There's so much pain and suffering in your mind that you become somehow inclined towards it. And that's all you can expect in the future. This is not the path to inner peace. It's the first one. The second path is the path of the ghost. In Buddhism, we understand there to be a realm or a dimension, I guess you could say, where the ghosts live, where ghosts live. And so they could be all around us and we may not see them. And for as someone who travels, it's quite interesting when you stay in different places, the energies you can feel and the kind of consciousness that comes to you. It kind of makes you believe that this is real, that these beings do exist. In the Buddha's time, we have lots of stories about ghosts. And they're not scary stories. Buddhist ghost stories are not stories that'll frighten you and give you nightmares at night. Buddhist ghost stories are stories that make you feel afraid for yourself. That if you have those same qualities in you, you might end up in that pitiful existence yourself. A ghost is a being that is without. A ghost is a being that is always cold. colder than this. We're okay. We've got each other to warm us up. We've got our love and our compassion for each other. We've got the Dharma to warm us. We don't need physical warmth. No, ghosts, they can't find enough clothes to wear or enough food to eat. They may be hounded by wild animals or birds or fire or all sorts of, you know, individual, their own their own chains or their own burden. But the characteristic of ghosts is that they are without. It's different from hell, because in hell you're with, you've got a lot of pain and suffering, and you're being brought through incredible torture. But a ghost is like a human being who is without, someone who lives in poverty, sometimes extreme poverty, in malnourishment, hunger. You see the pictures of people living in countries where they don't get enough to eat. And the Buddha said, and according to the Dhamma, there is a reason for this. And it all really makes sense. It's just a theory, and you can, as I said, you can try for yourself and see. But it really does make sense. If you're able to remember your past lives, maybe you can remember some of this. But the cause that leads us to this state is greed. It's the opposite of anger. Our attachments, our needs. Now, most of us need things, and most of us want things, most of us like things. If we're not fully enlightened beings, we will still have some sort of greed in us. But this isn't really what is meant here. A person who is on the path to become a ghost is someone who lets the greed overpower them and run their lives to the point that they hurt other people. They take what isn't theirs. They take more than their share in this life. It's kind of like we're allotted so much in life. It really is like that. And if we're not generous, if we're not kind to others, if we're not giving, if we're not open and loving and compassionate, then we've only got so much our portion that we can take. And if we take more than that, then we're going to run out before our time. And our next life, our next existence, or even in this existence, in the future, we will be without. You can see this for people who, there's a lot of conflict going on in North Africa, I think. You have these people who were very rich before and very powerful, and they abused it. That's what it seems like. And this is not a new story. You know, the story of people who abuse their wealth and in the end suffer for it. In the end, become the villains and are punished and tortured by it. Eventually it runs out. We always wonder why evil people can rise to power and can be so successful in life. One man in Sri Lanka, he said to me, why is it that the crooks always rise to the top, always rise to power? I think the answer, it's not very difficult. The answer is that they're the only ones who want to take the power. They're the only ones who are so unaware of the spiritual consequences that they take it, and no one is going to contest them. And what I'd like to say is that there are consequences to taking more than your share. If someone comes to power and abuses that power, there are consequences. If someone takes more than their share, is greedy, you know, based on their greed, if not in this life, then in the next life they will be born as a hungry ghost. In the Buddha's time, as I said, we have these stories, and the interesting feature of all of these stories is that whenever one of the monks or the Buddha himself saw one of these ghosts, they would smile. And you think it's such a sadistic thing to do when you see someone suffering so terribly. But the reason they smiled is not because of the suffering of the other person, but it's because of the inner peace that they themselves had found, realizing that they were free from this cycle. No, this person is pitiable. But what is pitiable is that they got themselves into the situation in the first place. That they have the delusion in their minds, and that they have such greed that they would lead themselves to that. The suffering is only temporary, but the greed will come back again to haunt them once they escape from the ghost realms. If they're not able to overcome their greed, and you know, maybe that's the point, is that through being in the ghost realm, they will be able to learn something. And next time they will be less hungry, or less greedy. So you can see the comparison here. This is not the path to peace. The people who have peace become very, very happy. You know, they smile when they see this because they realize that they're free from it. The third path that we recognize is the path to be born an animal. In Buddhism, we understand that animals are beings just like everyone else. We don't believe that we can own another being, we can own an animal. And I talked with this woman on the airplane who raises horses. And this is what she was realizing, I think. She's not Buddhist, but we were talking about it, and we were talking about meditation, and I was explaining some to her. And she was realizing that her horse was a being as well. That, you know, it suffered as well, and it had feelings as well, and she couldn't just use it and control it and force it to do what she wanted. And so what she started doing, she said she had started doing, was talking to her horse, you know, considering its feelings and saying, look, I'd like if you could, or we're going to go to this show and so on. Or, you know, talking with it and at least considering its feelings. And she was amazed that actually the behavior of the horse improved considerably. I don't think this is new to most of us. We do recognize this. But I think living in the West, the culture doesn't allow us to recognize it, and it's not clear, so we can often forget it. That they could have also been in the past life, they could have been our mothers, our fathers, our sisters, our brothers, or our children. Buddha said it's hard to find a being who was not at some point one of our relatives. So what's the difference between us and animal and other animals? Is it, some people even look at animals and think that they're so happy. We think it's enviable. Better if I was born a bird. No. Better if I was born a dog. Better. Some people say this. They say, oh, look at the dog. They don't do anything. They can just sit around all day. They don't have to work. It's a pretty superficial kind of thought. Dangerous as well. Because as I said, whatever you think of, whatever you wish for, whatever you incline your mind towards, that's the way you head. The characteristic of animals, the characteristic difference of other animal beings on this planet is, well, we can see they don't have the same level of intellect as we have. They could, from an emotional point of view, be more moral than some human beings. But they'll never have the same level of intellect. They'll never be able to invent an iPad, right? Or Facebook. So, what leads you to be born in relation to human beings as an animal is to have more delusion, more moha. more cloud in your mind, more darkness. Human beings are special. We're the only species on earth that can blow ourselves up. Isn't that smart? That's what intelligence does for you. It's not necessarily a positive thing. It is a very powerful thing, and it's a great thing to have. But, you know, putting powerful things in the hands of those who don't know how to use them, or those who would abuse them, misuse them, is dangerous. Dangerous to that person, dangerous to others as well. So human beings have this great capacity, and it's a great thing. You know, having power is a good thing. But you can abuse good things. You can abuse things that are of benefit, that are of benefit to yourself. You can use them for good, you can use them for bad. But this is what we have. Good or bad, we have some intellect that our fellow animals don't have. And this is based on good karma. It's based on a relatively good karma, that we've done good things in the past in regards to moha, in regards to clearing up our delusion and our ignorance. It means that at the very least we have studied and we have learned and we have listened and we have watched. And so if for all of you who are wondering why you have to go to school, why you have to learn all these things, this is what it takes to be a human being. You have to learn so many different things. The basic you have to learn is how your place in the universe, who you are and what you are, and what are the things that you have to do to progress, and what are the things that lead you to failure, to your detriment. You don't have to learn about all of the, you don't have to learn everything. But the learning that we do in this life, asking questions, listening to talks like this, why you have to come and sit here in the cold and listen to me go on and on and on, is because if we don't do this, if we don't keep ourselves on our toes, if we don't keep ourselves cognizant of these things, then we're liable to fall into a state of delusion, where we say, better off to be a dog. People who drink alcohol and take drugs and so on, you can see it in their face. They look like animals. We don't want to be like that. Someone who lives only to eat and to sleep and to indulge in sensuality, thinking that all there is the materialistic pleasures, they become very coarse beings. People who don't believe in the afterlife, you can tend to see a coarseness about them. Who believe that this is it. That if you want to be happy, find pleasure in this life, and you know, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die. If you're a sensitive individual, I think you can see. I mean, from my experience, you can see that there's coarseness there. I know I've had it when I was in that. And it's that coarseness that we're talking about here that differentiates us differentiates us from animals. We don't have, or we've less of that coarseness. And if we develop that coarseness, we go to be born as animals. So this is why we're here doing our Buddhist practice and trying to better ourselves. Because we want to find peace. We want to find true peace and bring peace to others. So by sharing this truth, this teaching amongst us, we're able to follow a path that leads us out of these dangers. So that's the third one. The fourth path is the path to be born a human. So look at all around at all of us. Everyone has their own life, their own individual path. But we've all done something in common that we should rejoice in, really. We should be happy about. And we should feel the bond that joins us, rather than concentrate on what separates us. What joins us together as human beings is that we have followed a certain path of development that has brought us to this point where we are actually quite close to the Buddha, both physically and mentally, much closer than most of the rest of the universe. We've brought ourselves here through our kusala karma, our beneficial and our wholesome deeds. The theory behind becoming a human is that you have to keep basic morality. You have to be basically a good individual. Maybe you have greed, maybe you have anger, maybe you have delusion. If you didn't have them, you wouldn't be born. So, most likely, they're still there. But you're able to control them. Why we all think that killing is wrong, stealing is wrong, why is it ingrained in us to some extent that these are not good things? Why do we cringe at the thought of hurting other beings? We have the desire to hurt as well, but why do we have this knowledge or this innate sense that we don't want to do these things, and in fact that we want to help others? Why do we have this desire to help others? Now, scientists will give you all sorts of ideas about how it's part of our genes and it's part of our development as a species and so on, and there's no quarrel there. But that's only explaining the course of events. It's not explaining why the universe is like this or why we happen to be brought into this physical form. The reason why you're here, why you're in this body, the reason why you've come to this point, and we've all come to this point, why are we all sitting here together? This is what we've done in the past. We've kept basic morality and kindness and generosity. We may not be perfect, most likely not. But we are good. We have goodness. This is encouraging. And we should be encouraged by this and think, I have in me some goodness. It's the proof is that I was born a human being. It means you've refrained from killing, you've refrained from stealing. You've developed this awareness, this consciousness in yourself, that these are coarse and unbeneficial things. But this isn't the path to inner peace. There are a lot of people who question the Buddha's teaching, thinking, you know, that there's really nothing wrong with the sensual pleasures, the enjoyment of the senses, you know, having good food. What's wrong with having good food? Watching movies, the sexual pleasure and sensual pleasure. What's wrong with all of these things? They're a part of nature. They're a part of being human. And this is the answer, is that this isn't the path to peace. If that's your path, then you'll be born again as a human. If all you do is what we've done so far, and you're content with this, then you'll come back. And I was talking to a Catholic woman when I was in university, and we were taking a Buddhism course together, and this is the first time she had heard of rebirth or reincarnation as a Catholic. She went to Catholic school when she was young. And she said to me, "Oh, it's so wonderful to know that I could come back and have another chance." And I thought that's quite novel, because most Buddhists look at it the opposite. They think, "Oh man, I've got to come back. If I'm not careful, I'm going to come back." But in the West, this is, you know, this is because they're used to it. They've heard it, and they've had time to digest it. But in the West, it's kind of, we've been brought up with, you know, if you're really good, you'll go to heaven. If you're, well, maybe you're even good, but if you do the wrong thing, and if you follow the wrong religion or don't follow the right religion, eternity in hell. This was what she had learned. And she thought, wow, this is, you know, wouldn't it be great if that were the truth? You know, that you could come back. But then the question is that we, as Buddhists, when we've had time to think about it, that we realize is that, well, okay, so maybe coming back once to sort of fix up all the stupid things I did, that'd be nice. But what about 100 times? What if I came back 1,000 times? What if, you know, if this were my path, would I really want to go through my teenage years again? You know, that kind of thing. Those of you who haven't gone through your teenage years yet, you'll know what I'm talking about in another 10 years. And so this isn't the path to inner peace. This is number 4. Number 5 is the path to the angel realms. To be born as an angel. I don't know if any of you have ever seen an angel before. I've seen a few people, very few people, 2-3 people in my lifetime, my short lifetime, I admit, that I would consider to be angelic. And they're wonderful to see and to watch. Their purity of mind. They're unlike any other being. They have such goodness in them, such purity, and it reflects in everything they do and say. And this is what the path to the angel realms is. You have to be really, really good. Like beyond anything that most of us have ever come in contact with. You have to be someone who is always conscious of the needs of other beings, always compassionate, always loving, always kind, always patient, always truthful, honest. Someone who develops themselves constantly, who has done things that make them deserve heaven. And it's worth noting that this is really one of the things that we get out of our Dharma practice, even in the here and now. When we help others, when we're kind to others, when we share things, even share our knowledge with them, we feel better about ourselves. We feel happier. And we get experiences like this. You know, how many people get this experience where they're sitting by the river, shivering, I know, but surrounded by good people. Look at what we're surrounded by. Next to the Peace Pagoda. I would have never thought it was possible. A Peace Pagoda in Canada, on public land. I'd like to hear the story of how that happened. This is what we get from our Dharma practice. We should consider this to be a good sign. Just the fact that we can come together here, that we're free from all of the troubles, that we're free from all of the defilements that people have that lead them now today to go to billiard halls and the things I saw on the way here. Lead them to go to bars and clubs and so on. Has led us here. And this isn't it. The Buddha said it's hard to give a comparison to heaven. You couldn't find anything here on earth that could even give a simile or a comparison. He said it's very hard to do. Such is the wonder of living, of being born in heaven. But it's not the path to inner peace either. We have stories of angels who came to see the Buddha realizing that they were about to die, that they were about to lose their heavenly bliss. There was one such angel who came to the Buddha and asked the Buddha, how do you find, where can you find true swasti? What is the true swastika? And the word swastika is a word that we're all familiar with, no, but we don't know where it comes from, most of us. Swastika, su-asti. Sva-asti. Sva means good, asti means being. Or well-being. What is it that leads to well-being? And the Buddha said there are four things. That only through the practice of wisdom, only through the practice of effort, only through the practice of restraint, and only through giving up everything can one find well-being. Even giving up heaven, the bliss of heaven. Because it's something that has a cause, and unless you're going to be good all the time, you know, once you get to heaven, it's kind of hard because you kind of get caught up in enjoying the pleasures. So angelic beings tend to forget to do good deeds, or to forget to listen to the Dharma and so on. And as a result, they become negligent and will fall from that state. The sixth path is the path to God, I guess you could say. I like to translate it this way. People always ask whether in Buddhism we have God or gods or so on. And the answer is, of course, yes, that we have something that you could, in a way, relate to God. It's the Brahma. The Brahma Loka. But in Buddhism we don't understand that Brahma created the world. We have this idea that Brahma thinks he created the world, but there's quite a difference. And they say how it happened is, if you're interested, is that one Brahma, he or she, I don't know, they don't really have gender, came down from a higher Brahma realm and was alone. And this is the realm that where it was in touch with the world that we have now. This would have been like the Big Bang kind of thing. But he forgot where he had been before, and so thought he was, you know, alone or the one, you know, he was the whole of the universe. But then he got lonely and thought, gee, wouldn't it be great if there were other beings here that I could share this with? And then, just so happened, after some time, that more Brahmas came down from the higher realms after him. And so he thought, gee, I created these Brahmas, isn't that great? And the story goes on and on and on. I don't know how much time I have, so I'm not going to go too far off track here. But there's a story about how Brahma thought he or she created the world, the universe. It's kind of how we relate to the world. You know, this whole thing about knock on wood, it must have come from the same sort of thing where someone just happened to be touching wood or something and it was bad, things were averted. This is how we work. We relate our experiences in this way because we have to learn, as you know, this is a genetic thing. We have to learn from our environment. We have to learn what is going to be dangerous and what is going to bring us safety. And so as a result, as a byproduct, we develop all sorts of mistaken connections and mistaken understandings. And this is where our idea of God comes as well. Where we don't understand the lightning, we don't understand the rain, we don't understand the seasons, we don't understand what brings disease and famine and so on. So it becomes demons, it becomes, you know, evil spirits or the gods or so on. But the nature of God or gods is is one of complete and total oneness. It sounds kind of boring, I suppose, but there's no boredom at that point. The mind is fixed and focused, and it doesn't mean just on one spot. The mind can be limitless. Some Brahmas are able to be aware of the whole of the universe. It can be a big ego trip as well. And they do it. They aren't free. What they aren't free from is ego. Brahmas are free from lust. They don't have bodies in the sense that we have. They're free from anger. They don't get upset. But they're not free from ego or delusion. So they have all sorts of ideas, and their existence is based on these ideas. Now the path that leads to the Brahma realms is the practice of meditation. But it's meditation based on ideas, based on concepts. And so there could be all sorts of types of Brahma. The examples that they give in the Buddha's teaching are the stock types of Brahma of God that we have. One type of God is someone who, as I said, contemplates infinite space. So this is a meditation that you can do. You can contemplate infinite space. There's actually a whole theory behind it. First you focus on a light. One type of meditator focuses on a light here, or a color, where their third eye would be. And if you concentrate on that, and if that becomes the whole of your awareness, so it can be a candle flame some people focus on, then this becomes your whole world. And this can be a type of rebirth that comes to you, that it leads you in that direction. Your mind is one-pointed. But then how you get to the higher Brahma realms is that you expand the light or the object to infinity. And when you do that, you're able to contemplate infinite space. And then you go on from there, infinite consciousness and nothingness. You give up this infinite space and consciousness, and you have nothing, and then it's emptiness, and so on. So the reason for talking about this as well is to be able to differentiate between what we consider to be the path to peace and this path. Because it's totally based on concepts and constructs. And as such, it's impermanent. It's something that is great and wonderful and exalted, but it's not something that lasts forever. So eventually you lose the force that brought you there and have to come back. There's a story of the Buddha was once walking on Pindapada, on alms, and he smiled. And you guys are probably going to think the Buddha was a bad person. But you have to understand the mind. The Buddha knows how he can help people and not how he can help, how he cannot, when he cannot help beings. He does his utmost to help beings, but he never feels suffering based on it. A Buddha would never feel sad when they saw someone suffering. Because they know what they can do to help, and they do it as appropriate. They have no idea of self or other. So they don't think about others first, they don't think about themselves first. They do what's appropriate at all times. They're always here, they're always now, and they're always appropriate. They're always doing the best thing that they can do. And so he smiled when he saw a pig by the side of the road. And the pig wasn't suffering, it was happy in the pig pen. This is, we have this story, the Buddha said, finding delight wherever you're born. Tatra tatra abhinandini. Wherever you're born, you find the light. And Ananda was walking behind him. Ananda was the Buddha's cousin. And Ananda asked the Buddha, "Why did you smile there when you saw the pig?" And the Buddha said, "I thought it was incredible when I saw this pig, because that pig used to be a Brahma." So we have this poem that goes, "In Brahma's realm she shines bright, in pig's pen too she finds delight." Something we can recite to our children. So it's something that's not permanent, and it's not the path to peace, the path to inner peace. So, after all this talking, I've gone through six, and we only have the number seven, the last and the actual path that leads to peace. The path that leads to peace has three basic parts to it. And these are the three, I believe it's the three higher trainings that were mentioned earlier. I'm assuming it's the same thing, that we're talking about the same thing. But the ultimate, the truth of the path to inner peace is understanding, is wisdom. Because nothing else, if you examine all of these other paths, none of them are permanent. All of them are based on the development of a specific mind state. No, they're all inside of ourselves. And when you develop that state of mind, that quality or that way of life, then it leads you to that state. The path to inner peace doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't take you away from who you are. It doesn't take you away from the world around you. It doesn't make you into something else. It doesn't take away something that you are. Sounds easy, no? The path to inner peace is to understand reality as it is, which is, I suppose, in a sense, the most difficult thing you could ever undertake to do. But on the other hand, it's one of the problems with this is it's too easy. You see, the problem is not reality. It's not who we are. It's that we don't know who we are. The problem is that we're not aware of who and what we are. We don't know what we're experiencing right now. When we experience reality, we do it just for a moment, one moment at a time. And right after that moment, we go racing off into delusion, into illusion. Right? Maybe you're listening to me talk, and there's many, many things going on in your mind. Just every moment that you, every word that you hear me say, there has to be so many things going on in your mind. In the beginning, there's the sound touching your ear. And I always encourage my students to try this. Those of you who came to the meditation course, I hope you had a chance to try it. When you hear something, just focus on it as being sound. Try to understand that this is what's really going on. When you do that, you get to see the whole process. You get to see the whole of reality of this experience. Because you'll see what comes next. Once there's hearing, then there is the recognition. You recognize that this is Yutta Dhamma, this is a monk. You recognize it's pleasant speech or no, you recognize that what is being said, you don't know it's pleasant yet. You recognize the words and the meaning of the words, and you're able to put it together and understand what is being said. And then you feel happy about it, or you feel unhappy, or maybe you feel neutral. And then after that, and so on and so on, then there is the liking or disliking, the judging. And then right away you're off on a tangent. You're thinking about it, or maybe it's boring, so you start thinking about something else. What am I going to do after? Maybe it's something else takes your attention and you're carried away, and so on. Most of our lives are spent in concepts, in conventional reality, thinking about things that don't really exist. I'll give a simple example. It's really very simple. When I at Vaisak, I asked, "What is this?" And someone said, "A fist." And I said, "Okay, where did the fist go?" It's just a simple example, but this is how everything works. We create these things in our mind, and they're useful for us. If you didn't know it was a fist, you wouldn't know to run, or so on. Not from my fist, you don't have to worry. But I know I'm fearsome and all, but in terms of understanding reality, we have to be able to differentiate. Because it's all of these illusions, all of these creations in our mind that create that give rise to our greed, our anger, our delusion, and all of the problems. You can't make war with. You can't fight a war based on atoms and particles. You need to put them together and say, "This is my enemy." It has to be. You have to create a being out of it. And then you have to name that being Osama bin Laden. And then he becomes the enemy. And you rejoice when he is killed, and so on. And so the path, the way out of this, and the way to true and lasting inner peace, is to simply understand it for what it is, to see the reality of your experience. Because it's the only thing that could possibly last. It's the only thing that could ever be, it could be permanent. I know, I'm always talking too long. But I'd like to just impart this to all of you, because I think everyone here has their own practice. And for those of you who have been following my practice, you can understand where I'm coming from. But just to be clear what we're aiming for. Because no matter where we go or what path we follow, or as long as it's based on a force, that force will never be permanent, will never last forever. Until it's based on understanding, something that changes the way we look at it, the way we look at our experience, we can never find true and lasting inner peace. Everyone in the world wants to find happiness. I would say all beings want to find happiness. Some have very twisted ideas about how to find it, but this is what they want. And yet, we have to ask the question, why then do so many beings do things that cause themselves suffering? I think this question puts everything into perspective. If you knew that something was going to cause you suffering, if you really knew, I submit to you that you would never ever do that action. Once we understand things for what they are, and we understand the consequences of what we do, I mean really understand, not intellectually, but we see clearly, as I said, watching the sound of the ear and so on, we will never do bad things again. So I submit to you that this is why we call the Buddha the Buddha. We don't call him by any of the other great qualities that he had. We call him Buddha because he knew. Buddha means one who knows. And the reason we call him that is because that's the most important quality of the Buddha, is that he came to know the things, he came to know the truth of reality, the truth of nature. So, I think my time has come, and I probably could have gone on for another hour, but we'll save it for next time. So thank you all for inviting me and for putting up with this. I feel much warmer. And I hope you all do too. And I'd like to wish you all the best. And I hope that you're all able to practice the Buddha's teaching and find true peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering for yourselves. Thank you. And have a happy Vesak.
To the end of our program. We will be ending with the chanting of